Hello and welcome to Science World. This past Wednesday was Earth Day. Aru Pandey tells us that U.S. President Barack Obama marked the day with a visit to the Everglades National Park in Florida, calling climate change the greatest threat to the planet. Friday was the Hubble Space Telescope's 25th anniversary, and Roseanne Scherbel previews its successor, the James Webb Space Telescope, which is being readied for a 2018 launch. And researchers recently combed through 100,000 galaxies and failed to find any evidence of extraterrestrial intelligence. Today on our one-on-one segment, we'll talk with a scientist from Penn State University's Center for Exoplanets and Habitable Worlds who conceived and initiated this search for intelligent life beyond Earth. We'll have these stories and more on today's edition of VOA's Science, Health, and Technology magazine, Science World. U.S. President Barack Obama says climate change, which he calls the greatest threat to the planet, can no longer be denied. He highlighted the issue on Wednesday during an Earth Day trip to Everglades National Park in Florida. Aru Pandey has more.
Home to alligators, herons, and hundreds of other animal and plant species, the Everglades National Park in Florida hosted a U.S. president on Wednesday. Barack Obama traveled to the natural area of 6,000 square kilometers with a message to the American people that climate change can no longer be denied.
2014 was the planet's warmest year on record. 14 of the 15 hottest years on record have fallen in the first 15 years of this century.
The president's Earth Day trip to the ecologically sensitive Everglades was aimed at getting Americans to think about the impact of climate change on the environment, people's health, their livelihoods, and the local economy.
As sea levels rise, salty water from ocean flows inward. This harms freshwater wildlife, which endangers a fragile ecosystem. The salt water flows into aquifers, which threatens the drinking water of more than 7 million Floridians.
The U.S. leader has advanced plans to cut carbon emissions by nearly a third by 2025. China has set a goal of leveling its rising emissions in 2030, perhaps before. The two countries are the world's largest polluters. At home, facing a Republican-majority Congress that is fighting his plans, President Obama on Wednesday hit back at critics who say measures to fight climate change hurt the U.S. economy.
This is not some impossible problem that we cannot solve. We can solve it if we've got some political will. And we can solve it in a way that creates jobs. We can solve it in a way that doesn't disrupt our economy, but enhances our economy.
Sam Adams, former mayor of Portland, Oregon, and now a director of the U.S. Climate Initiative at the Washington-based World Resources Institute, says climate change should not be a political issue.
Regardless of why people think sea level is rise is happening, or why there's a drought or an anemic snowpack in the Rockies in the Pacific Northwest, regardless of the reasons for why people might think that's happening, I think that Democrats and Republicans, conservatives and liberals can and should come together to address those issues.
Adams says despite the back and forth in Washington, opinion polls show the American public's concern about climate change is reaching an all-time high, and support for climate action is cutting across the political divide. Aru Pandey, VOA News, Washington.
Friday, April 24th, marked the 25th anniversary of the Hubble Space Telescope. Its successor, the James Webb Space Telescope, is currently being assembled and tested prior to its launch in 2018. Roseanne Scherbel tells us that the new observatory is expected to expand on the knowledge that has been provided from Hubble.
The Hubble and the Webb telescopes have a lot in common. Both work in the vacuum of space, have mirrors that collect light from distant stars, use radio signals to transmit images, and get power from the sun. But the similarities end there, says Matt Greenhouse, a project scientist for the James Webb Space Telescope.
The Webb, as we call it, is the successor to the Hubble Space Telescope. And it's designed to do science that the Hubble can't do by virtue of its design. One of the biggest differences between the Webb and the Hubble is that the Webb is designed to be an infrared telescope. It will allow the Webb to see these very primordial objects, these objects that are among the oldest objects in the universe.
And to do that, the Webb will be sent 1.5 million kilometers above the Earth's atmosphere, unlike Hubble, which flies in low Earth orbit and sees only visible, ultraviolet, and a small segment of the infrared spectrum.
With infrared radiation, we can peer through clouds of dust in space that obscure regions where stars are being born around us today. With spectroscopy, which is spreading light out into its component colors and observing them one at a time, we can see features of individual atoms and molecules in space that will allow us to understand the chemistry that occurs in space. Many of those features only exist in the infrared part of the spectrum.
Webb's mirror is also more than six times bigger than Hubble's, which will enable it to see objects that are fainter and further away. Made from lightweight beryllium and coated in gold for its reflective qualities, the segmented mirror was too large to fit in the rocket that would carry it, so it was designed to unfold in space. The Webb is shielded by a multi-layer sunscreen to keep light from the sun and reflected light from the Earth and Moon from heating up the telescope and blocking astronomical signals. For it to work, Greenhouse says, the Webb must be in an orbit with those three bodies lined up in about the same direction.
And so we can take advantage of that and deploy a giant sunshield that will allow the telescope to always live in the shadow of the sunshield. And when it's in that shadow, it will cool naturally to this cryogenic temperature.
All the Webb's cutting-edge technologies combine to make the telescope 100 times more powerful than Hubble.
We have special capability in this instrument payload to observe as many as 100 galaxies at a time and obtain their spectra simultaneously.
With a launch date just 3 years away, the Webb has entered its assembly and testing phase. Watching work in progress from windows overlooking an airtight clean room at Goddard Space Flight Center in Greenbelt, Maryland, Greenhouse says the Webb must avoid the error that sent Hubble into space with a flawed mirror.
One of the big things that we learned from the Hubble is the Hubble didn't do something called an end-to-end optical test, where we take the entire observatory and shine light through it the way it will be done in space and make sure everything works.
Unlike the Hubble, the Webb cannot be repaired in space, so the team has only one chance to get it right. Greenhouse, who has been with the Webb almost the entire life of the project, expects the new telescope to rewrite textbooks much the same way as Hubble.
And like Hubble, it's likely that after this mission is over, we'll look back and find that the most important discoveries and the most important questions that were answered are not the questions that we had in mind when we designed and built it.
The Hubble has operated much longer than expected, and Greenhouse hopes the Webb will too. The James Webb Space Telescope is a project of the United States, European, and Canadian space agencies. Roseanne Skirbel, VOA News, Washington.
It's time for this week's Science World Quick Quiz, and as you just heard, Friday, April 24th was the Hubble Space Telescope's 25th anniversary. One of the former U.S. space shuttles actually carried and deployed the Hubble into space. Which one? Was it A, Discovery, B, Atlantis, or C, Endeavour? Think about it. We'll have the correct answer for you in a few minutes from now.
You're listening to Science World on VOA. You can also find us on the Internet. Our new webpage and blog can be found at voanews.com/science.
Security experts say China has created a powerful new tool to censor the Internet. It's a tool that lets the communist government spy on Internet users worldwide who access Chinese websites. Shannon Van Zandt reports.
China has long censored the Internet with its so-called Great Firewall, but now researchers from the University of California, Berkeley, and the University of Toronto say Beijing is employing a new method that has the capability to attack websites hosted on servers located abroad. Security experts have dubbed the censorship tool the Great Cannon and say China can now redirect traffic intended for Chinese websites to whatever sites the authorities choose. That can overwhelm the sites with an enormous number of hits, overloading, and temporarily disabling them. Ben Fitzgerald is a fellow at the Center for a New American Security.
So the Great Firewall could stop information getting through to Chinese citizens. The Great Cannon allows the Chinese government to go and attack the websites that Chinese people are trying to access.
China has recently hijacked traffic to the Chinese web search engine Baidu and redirected it to target GitHub and GreatFire.org. Those sites publish so-called mirrors of websites that are blocked by the Great Firewall so that they can be accessible to people within China. But the state strategy of redirecting China's internet traffic to cripple foreign websites could hurt Chinese businesses. Baidu is China's biggest search engine and the fourth most popular website in the world. China's new method of launching cyber attacks could discourage people from visiting sites like Baidu at a time when Chinese internet companies like equipment maker Huawei are looking to expand their brand name and market share abroad.
So I think that in the same way that we've seen a lot of businesses internationally being fearful of installing Huawei devices on their networks for the potential or the perception of security risks, we can now see that for other companies like Baidu.
Researchers say the Great Cannon can not only cripple websites China wants to remain inaccessible to the Chinese public, but can also be used to spy on anyone who visits a Chinese website or a site with Chinese advertising. Patrick Chovanec is a managing director of Silvercrest Asset Management Group and a professor at Columbia University's School of International and Public Affairs.
And for anybody who's going to think about accessing Baidu or similar sites, that's going to that may cause them to think twice. It's also been reported that not just accessing the sites themselves, but even indirectly accessing sites, Chinese sites, even via sites that you think are safe, might have the same effect. So, you know, in this environment where we're all concerned about privacy and we're also all concerned about cybersecurity, I think that anything that puts a site, puts a question mark over the safety of a site is going to be a problem for them.
After observing attacks by the Great Cannon, University of Toronto researchers concluded the repurposing of the devices of unwitting users in foreign jurisdictions for covert attacks in the interest of one country's national priorities is a dangerous precedent, contrary to international norms and in violation of widespread domestic laws prohibiting the unauthorized use of computing and network systems. However, the tool appears to be similar to cyber attack technologies used by the United States and Britain, according to documents leaked by former National Security Agency contractor Edward Snowden. James Lewis of the Washington, D.C.-based Center for Strategic and International Studies says tensions between the United States and China over cybersecurity have continued to rise over the last year.
Well, they've gotten worse. You know, both sides are a little more aggressive in dealing with the issues. The Chinese, of course, have started a whole new campaign to control the internet, right? And to have a lot larger role in determining how the internet operates and what appears on it.
Over the past few months, China has further restricted access to the internet for Chinese users, blocking popular applications like Gmail and services called VPNs, or virtual private networks, that allow internet users in China to evade censorship controls. Shannon Van Sant for VOA News, Hong Kong.
Some people seem to get bitten by mosquitoes more than others. Now scientists have proved that this is really the case, and they say it is all because of our genes. It is hoped the research might lead to new preventative treatments for mosquito-borne diseases like malaria and dengue fever. Henry Ridgewell reports from London.
The unmistakably irritating sound of a mosquito on the lookout for its next meal. Researchers say that given a choice, mosquitoes find some people more tasty than others. And now there is the science to prove it. Dr. James Logan is from the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine.
So we decided to look at this in a study using twins, where we compared the attractiveness of identical twins and non-identical twins.
In collaboration with the University of Florida in the United States, Dr. Logan and his team performed a series of trials using 18 identical and 19 non-identical female twins. Mosquitoes were released down Y-shaped tubes and chose which twin they wanted to bite by turning left or right. Identical twins had a very similar level of attractiveness to the mosquitoes, while non-identical twins differed. Again, Dr. Logan.
So the gnat suggests that the trait for being attractive or unattractive to mosquitoes is controlled by our genes. We know that if you're unattractive to mosquitoes, you produce natural repellents. So it's likely that the genes that are controlling how attractive we are controlling the odours being produced by our body.
Researchers are conducting further work which they hope could lead to new preventative treatments.
Once we know which genes are involved, we might be able to assess a population for their level of risk of being bitten by a mosquito and therefore their risk of a disease like malaria or dengue, and B, we might be able to develop a drug that you could take and that creating a sort of upregulation of repellents by the body naturally, which would repel mosquitoes.
Mosquitoes transmit diseases like malaria, which kills around 500,000 people a year. Thanks to better preventative measures and new drugs, the World Health Organization reports a 47% fall in malaria deaths in the past decade, the equivalent of about 3.9 million children's deaths averted. Professor Pedro L. Alonso is director of the WHO's Global Malaria Program.
I would actually call it unprecedented progress in the fight against malaria. So still, 97 countries around the globe have continued transmission of this parasite. That means that around 3.2 billion people remain at risk of that infection.
With such a high prevalence, there are many anecdotal theories on how to deter mosquitoes, as varied as eating garlic, drinking beer, or ingesting high levels of vitamin B. But scientists say there is no evidence that eating any particular food will stop the mosquitoes biting. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Do you have the correct answer to this week's Science World Quick Quiz? Well, let's find out. Which of the former U.S. space shuttles actually carried and deployed the Hubble into space? Was it A, Discovery, B, Atlantis, or C, Endeavour? The answer is A. The Hubble was carried into space aboard the shuttle Discovery and was deployed on April 25, 1990. The space telescope was put into service less than a month later on May 20th, 1990. Thanks for playing along with us on this week's Science World Quick Quiz. We'll have another brain teaser for you again next week.
Thanks for listening to VOA Science, Health, and Technology News Magazine, Science World. Be sure to visit our new website and blog at voanews.com/science.
Is there intelligent life out there in the cosmos, beyond Earth? The possibility of intelligent life somewhere out there has long charged our imagination and inspired countless books, movies, and television programs. Past efforts in the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, or ETI, have so far been unsuccessful, and research that was recently conducted by a group of scientists who analyzed data from NASA's Wise Orbiting Observatory also failed to find any evidence of intelligent life from among the 100,000 galaxies they studied. Jason T. Wright from Penn State University's Center for Exoplanets and Habitable Worlds came up with the idea for the research project. He joins us to talk about his team's search for extraterrestrial intelligence.
What we were looking for in other galaxies is the heat that might come from advanced alien civilizations' industry. So we don't know what an advanced alien civilization might do with energy, but if they use very large amounts of energy, and if they have colonized all of the stars in their galaxy, then they should give off heat, for the same reason that if you plug an appliance into the wall or your computer into the wall and you turn it on, your computer will get hot. And that's because it's using energy, and when it's done with the energy, it has to get rid of the energy as heat. So if you could see the infrared radiation that comes from the appliance or the computer, this is a form of light that has longer wavelengths than the normal light that we see with our eyes. You can feel with your hand, if you hold it out in front of a warm object, you can feel the heat, the radiation coming off of the object. We looked for that same heat that might be coming from alien industry in these other 100,000 galaxies.
How does your search for intelligent life differ from other efforts?
There are many different SETI searches. One of them is based at the SETI Institute in California, and they use radio telescopes to listen for potential radio wave communication from alien civilizations. There are also other groups that look for laser communication. They might be shining lasers to try and communicate. We are taking a different approach. We're not assuming or hoping that the alien civilizations would be trying to communicate either with us or with one another. We are just hoping that they use enough energy that it might be detectable. So we're hoping that this is a more general way to go looking for aliens because it's a little less dependent on guessing what they might do. The disadvantage to this search is that at the moment, we're only sensitive to extremely large amounts of energy being used by alien civilization. So to give you a sense of the scale, across the whole galaxy, they would have to be using almost as much energy as all of the stars in the galaxy. So a typical one of these galaxies might contain 100 billion stars, and all of those stars together put out a lot of energy. And if the alien industry is using almost that much energy or more than that much energy, then we would have been sensitive enough to notice the extra energy coming from the galaxies and known to go looking more carefully to see what's going on there. So when we see infrared radiation, we can't be sure yet because we haven't looked carefully enough whether we're looking at natural radiation or we're looking at radiation perhaps from alien industry. And so right now we can only put an upper limit on how much alien industry there might be in one of these galaxies. So we found that there aren't any galaxies where most of the energy in the galaxy is coming out as this heat. We found plenty of heat coming from galaxies, but we presume at this point that most of the heat that we've seen is natural. Our next follow-up will be to study the radiation that we're seeing and see if it's consistent with natural sources like astrophysical dust, or if there's something anomalous about it that means it might be alien industry. So we will become much more sensitive to distinguishing alien heat from dust as we work harder on this data set.
Among the 100,000 galaxies that you studied, I'm sure there were at least a couple that piqued your interest. Were there any galaxies, anything out there that you think deserves further study?
Definitely. We know that there is a class of galaxy that has extremely high rates of star formation. New stars are being born in these galaxies at a high rate, and they give off a lot of energy, and there's a lot of dust in that process. And so those are galaxies, which we call starburst galaxies, produce huge amounts of infrared radiation. And we know about these galaxies, and they're rare. And so we expected that those would be the ones that went to the top of our list. And indeed, most of them are starbursts. They're well known to astronomers. We've been studying them for decades. But we found three that apparently had never been studied before. And so we can't actually be sure that they're starbursts yet because no one has done the hard work of studying the light from the galaxies and showing that that's what they are. So those are intriguing at the moment because they have a lot of infrared radiation, and we aren't exactly sure why yet. We also found some interesting sources inside our own Milky Way galaxy that astronomers hadn't noticed before. There's a bright star in the sky that turns out to have a huge nebula around it that had never been noticed. And we also found what is probably a new cluster, new to science, of stars forming deep inside of a cloud of dust. So there's nothing alien about those latter two sources that I mentioned, but they're very astrophysically interesting. So I'm interested as an astronomer in figuring out more about them.
That was Professor Jason T. Wright from the Center for Exoplanets and Habitable Worlds at Penn State University in State College, Pennsylvania. That's it for this edition of Science World. Thanks so much for listening. Before we go, we'd like to invite you to visit our webpage and blog. Along with program information, you'll find stories, links, and much more. Our web address is voanews.com/science. This is Rick Pantaleo reminding you to join us either online or on your radio next Saturday and Sunday as we check out the latest in science, health, and technology on Science World.